Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and we're joined today by Catherine Wilcox. Catherine is the president of Resource Mosaic, based in Atlanta, where she excels in executive cert, specializing in accounting and finance across the Southeast. She joined Resource Mosaic in 2011 and actually took over the business in 2022. With a background in entertainment and accounting, Catherine boasts a proven track record of connecting top talent with growth opportunities. She's a member of the Pinnacle Society, which is a fantastic group of people who are among the top producing recruiters in the United States. She's also a member of our coaching program. Catherine, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
So we first met at a Pinnacle conference, actually, in San Diego in 2023, and then again at the one in Savannah, Georgia. And we got to sit next to each other at dinner, which was fun. It's such an awesome group of people, and I'm so happy that it allowed us to get to know each other.
Absolutely. No, the Pinnacle side has been phenomenal. I mean, I've only been part of it for, a year now. It's only been a year. And it's been an absolute blast. And I had so much fun sitting at dinner with you that night. We got to know each other. It was awesome.
Yeah. And that was quite a table. We also, we were sitting with Monty Mertz and Nate Zimmerman. I'm sure there was a couple other people, but that was quite an impressive table. And they've both been on the show as well and did, you know, gave so much value. So that is, you know, we're really thrilled to be Pinnacle partners because it's such a high quality group of people. So Catherine, can you just set the scene? Tell us the story of how you got into recruiting.
I guess I kind of fell into it, honestly. I started my career in LA. I'm a California girl at heart, never going to lose that part of me. I went to UCLA, and after UCLA, I ended up at the William Morris Agency, working with talent across the spectrum. And when I decided to part ways with that part, it wasn't working for me. I ended up in the Southeast. My dad's originally from Charleston, and actually lived with my grandparents for a little bit of time, trying to figure out what my next path was. And I landed in Atlanta and had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I mean, I think this is like the epitome of a quarter life crisis I was having. And a friend just said, "Hey, you need to be doing this. You need to try this out." And I interviewed at Lucas Group, and the rest is history.
Fantastic! Wow, yeah. There's a lot.
Right?
I want to go back to your experience working in a talent agency because that's pretty cool and interesting, and I can see some potential parallels between that and recruiting. Can you say a little more about what that involved and what that was like as your kind of first career working in a huge global talent agency?
I mean, it kicked my butt, honestly. I think that's the best way to put it. I mean, everybody's trying to get somewhere in Hollywood, right? So you constantly have to be on. I was having a blast. I mean, my early 20s, I have some great stories. I had so much fun. And I met great people. But I think really where I think it always been part of me, even when I was in college, I had worked with friends who were in the theater department, putting on shows. I always really loved helping people get somewhere, right? Like it was just a blast. I didn't need to be the one on stage, but I wanted to be part of the process of getting their work on stage or helping them get on stage or whatever they were trying to accomplish. And that's what gave me my rush, was just to be part of that group. So William Morris Agency, I always thought actually I was going to go into entertainment law, believe it or not. But I thought the William Morris Agency would be a great way to get a foundation in the entertainment business. And I started off in commercials, doing international commercials, and then ended up in a space called music crossover, putting musicians into film and TV. And I don't know, it was fun. So I guess, you know, we were talking earlier, it really gave me a real respect for talent. Talent to me is the number one, even in my world today. And I love working with great people trying to accomplish great things and being part of the process, even if it's just a tiny little piece of helping them land somewhere.
I love that. And I see the common theme being talent till they get that. Could you share, like, were there any other things that you learned in that environment which have translated over into your recruiting career?
Definitely the art of the hustle, right? You have to keep going, right? I mean, everybody thinks recruiting is an easy job that we do, or executive search, however you want to define it, right? And you have to hustle every single day. And in Hollywood, when you're working, and I mean, everybody's chomping at your heels, right? Everybody wants a piece. Everyone wants to knock the people off, right? Somebody wanted my job. So you always had to be going and you had to be on. So, I mean, you'd get up early and you'd crank it and work all day. And then I'd be at shows all night, like seeing bands and, you know, hanging out with all the music people, or out at, you know, premieres, working, like talking with people who were on the movie side, since I kind of played in between. And you just had to keep going and just hustle, and get to know as many people as you possibly could.
Fantastic. Yeah, I totally see that being similar to executive search for a lot of reasons. So then you ended up in Atlanta, which is a fantastic city. I've only been once, but I loved it. And I am going back because that's where the next Pinnacle conference
is. Yeah, we'll see you in a couple months.
Yeah, see you there. I actually have a childhood friend who lives there. Like my mom and her mom were best friends growing up. And so we weren't related, but we're kind of like cousins. And she settled in Atlanta. So I got to meet her last year when I was there, and hopefully connect with her again. So then you joined the Lucas Group, which is a well-known recruiting company. And then what I'd love to hear, double-click on, Catherine, is your journey at Resource Mosaic, because you joined in 2011 as a senior recruiter, senior partner.
Yeah, then as a director.
And then you actually took over the company. So tell me that story of how you ended up acquiring the business.
I spent, I can't remember how long it was, 5-6 years with Lucas Group. And it was a great foundation. I mean, I loved my time there. I joined actually when Art Lucas still owned the business, and it was a blast. And then he sold to private equity, and just the culture changed for me. And I really wanted to get to a boutique shop. What I realized working at Lucas Group is I was kind of told to stay in my lane, right? Like I had to work the accounting and finance market in Atlanta specifically. And as I was achieving some success, my clients were trying to pull me into other searches, and I was losing the ability to service my clients in that just environment. So I started looking for a boutique shop. I wanted something that was small that I could leave my mark on. I could kind of see where it went. And I was introduced to Ken Richards, who founded Resource Mosaic, and we hit it off and kind of kept talking, and it kind of worked out. But I joined where it was, you know, he'd been kind of working. It'd been a very small shop. He'd been a partner at Deloitte. He wasn't a recruiter of kind of growing up in the business. So we complemented each other very well, where he taught me so much about business and sales and client development. And I like to think I taught him a little bit about recruiting, right? Like just the hustle that I mentioned before. And I landed there, and I was given the freedom to spread my wings, right? Like I was able to go after anything I wanted, build the relationships that I wanted. And I really found a passion for building teams. So a lot of my work tends to be underneath the CFO. So anything that can report to a CFO, you know, whether it be a VP, director level, that tends to be my bread and butter. So, but I also discovered that a lot of other things could report to the CFO. It can be IT, it can be HR, it can be legal. And I loved having some variety and diversity in what I was doing. And it was just a blast. And Ken just took such great care of me, made great introductions with his network. And we were able to, I think, build something really special. It's still small. There's only 3.5 of us, but it's more of a family than anything else.
I love it. That's such a cool story. And so I'm going to make a note and circle back to this idea of building out teams and maybe get into some of the like more interesting projects that you've been involved in delivering. But could you say more about how you went from being a director to being the business owner? Because I think that's an interesting topic from both parties' perspectives. So there'll be people listening who are business owners who might want to retire or exit at some point. And so, but often we're told it's hard to really sell a small business where you're like, there's only a handful of people. So that would be interesting to know a success story of how that actually happened. But then also the reverse being true, there may be really ambitious listeners who are currently employed in a recruitment agency or a search firm who would aspire to be a business owner. And this maybe creates an inspiration for a career path for them. So could you tell more about that story?
Yeah, I mean, Ken and I worked together a really long time, right? I mean, we just got to know each other so well. We were sitting just like a few feet away from each other for most of that time. And he really just started to take care of me at the end of the day. I mean, I had my twins during that time, which was crazy. He was phenomenally supportive. And there was just a mutual trust and respect that we had. I think he always used to make fun of me because when I walk into the office, I'm on. Like, I'm blinders on. I don't even say good morning. Like, I just walk in, I set up my desk, and I go. And he would be like, good morning, Catherine. You've been here for 2 hours. Nice to see you. And we just had just a really great, I think he trusted me. I trusted him. And when he was reaching a point where he had some other endeavors he wanted to get involved in and focus his time on, it was such a compliment. I mean, it kind of makes me tear up when I think about it. I mean, it's the biggest compliment you can get when somebody takes something that they've been working on for, I don't know, 15, 20 years and says, you're the right person for this. I trust you to do what's right and take Resource Mosaic forward. And, you know, I didn't even know it was coming. I was like, wait, what?
Oh, wow.
Like, so I was very happy and comfortable at this point. And all of a sudden he was like, I mean, it was like, I honestly felt like a bird being pushed out of its nest, out of the nest to fly. Like, it's your time. And within a few months, we worked something out and I was off to the races. So it's only been 2 years since that happened, but it's been a blast. And I think about how thankful I am to have met him and have worked with him and have him as a mentor every single day.
Wow. That's awesome. So I hadn't realized you weren't even looking for that necessarily, that the opportunity was presented and you grabbed it, which is a great decision. And I'm really happy for you that it's working out so well. But you made it sound real simple, like, and I think it, obviously you'd already worked together. So this is the benefit of this kind of an MBO versus a trade sale, is that you already have that history together. So that certainly gave you a head start, but presumably there still must have been some formalities and due diligence and like process that you had to put in place, and then financing and, you know, how long did that whole process take, and what were the kind of main kind of steps you had to go through?
Honestly, it was about 4 months from the initial conversation to the transaction. So I didn't really need to do the due diligence because I was the business at that point. I knew the ins and outs. I knew what was going on. We just had to settle on specific terms.
Yeah.
And he sold me the business, but he gave me a great price for it. I mean, he wanted to do right by the business and me, and he's still involved to this day. So right. He still wants to, you know, connect me with opportunities and people. So we still work together and have a great connection. But yeah, I mean, it was outside of me having some small panic attacks along the way, realizing I was suddenly going to be a business owner. It was actually a pretty smooth process, probably because neither of us wanted to be one. We wanted it to be fair.
Yes.
And I knew what he was doing he was being more than fair on his end.
Okay.
So I was willing to do whatever we needed to do. And he kind of handed the keys over to me, you know, on January 1 and just said, hey, it's yours. So I hate to say it, but I think maybe because we had so much trust in each other, it really did feel very simple because I wasn't trying to take from him and he wasn't trying to take from me. We were just trying to find a nice, easy off ramp where he knew the business was in good hands and he could focus on everything else that he was working on. And I was in a place where I wasn't saddled with so much debt that I was going to be in kind of panic mode right now for an extended period of time.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, for sure. And that's fantastic that you found that common ground and that point where you both felt it was a good deal and you're still good friends and still work together. So so that's cool. And I'm just intensely curious about this, like even the whole challenge of valuing small companies, because so I went through a valuation process recently, as you know, my colleague Leanne, who's an integral part of our business, and I made her a shareholder this year. And in order to, you know, give shares to someone, then you obviously need to know, well, what are those shares worth? And there's that valuation. But I think that's a little different, because when you're valuing a business to give shares to someone, you actually want a low valuation, because otherwise there's going to be a tax implication, right? If you're giving someone shares that have value, then immediately the Inland Revenue, or the HMRC as they're called here, are going to want a big chunk of cash right away. So we actually went about it in a different way. And there's a scheme here in the UK called, where it's a share class called growth shares, where the person essentially gets to participate in the value of the growth from that point onward. So that way, the value exchange is minimal, and they don't have any tax burden at that point. So, but going through that process, what I learned is they go through this, you know, they have to justify the valuation, because then if the tax man does have questions about it, they have to show that there was some kind of rigorous process involved. And of course, what they look at is other transactions in your same industry, right? But there's, number one, there's a limited number of transactions to look at. And the multiples are all over the place, you know, and then all of those transactions are way bigger than your company. So then they have to decrease the value, taking into account factors like, you know, the fact that there's, you know, how predictable is the growth in earnings, right? And, you know, how predictable and sustainable is that? And so anyway, it's a long, convoluted process. How did you guys go about that?
It was actually literally that simple. He was like, I'm thinking this amount. And I'm okay. Like, that seems fair.
Okay. Oh, wow.
We just went with it. Like, it was that
holy
simple.
Holy smokes.
But
okay.
I really think that it was rooted in how long I'd worked with him. And I think he was pricing it knowing how much effort I had done to build our brand and how far we'd come in whatever the 10 years that we'd worked together. So he factored a lot of that in, and just, I mean, it was on, he's like, I'm thinking this. I'm like, that sounds good. Let's go with it. So, I mean, he was so fair and so honest. And I mean, he pretty much wrapped it up with a bow and handed it to me. So it was, we did not have a very complex process, just because I think he was so generous with me, and it was just an absolute honor.
Fantastic. I mean, ultimately, if it works for both of you, then that's a perfect outcome, right? Do you mind sharing how you financed the deal?
He actually just told me to pay him a certain amount over, basically, he gave me the interest-free loan.
Great.
So he said, how about you pay me this every year for this many years? And that's what I've just been doing. I just paid my last just this past December. So we did it over 2 years.
Fantastic.
So yeah.
All right.
So, I mean, it was more than generous. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. That sounds ideal for both parties then. And it gives a model then of what could be done if a small boutique owner does want to exit. There are ways of doing that and ensuring. I think it sounds like Ken's overriding concern was the legacy. He wanted Resource Mosaic to continue, for the clients to be looked after, and so on. And so that for that to continue beyond his involvement, and you were the right person. He felt like the business was in good hands. So, and then secondarily, of course, you know, after putting in all of that work to build something, you want to capture some value as well, right? And so that sounds awesome. That's cool.
I was very lucky to partner with Ken and join his team, because he's been overwhelmingly fair. And I think he wanted to take care of me, right? I think that this was, we just became so close through this process. It was more than work. A lot of times it was personal. We just knew each other so well. And it just worked out great.
Let's pick up then on the idea that you sort of mentioned earlier about building teams, and it's something you find exciting. Are you able to share, like, without obviously going into any confidential details, but is there a project or a, you know, that you were involved in that stands out in your mind as almost a case study of something that, went phenomenally well. You were proud of what you accomplished and the client was delighted with the outcome as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I won't get into names or anything like that, but I tend to, for some reason, I'm very confidential with company and client names that I work with. I don't
Fair
know
enough.
Why, but yeah. You know, there was, and this was about 10 years ago, I think, 8-10 years ago, I worked with a business that was spinning off of a Fortune 500 company. And the new CFO was a previous client of mine, a client I love working with. Actually, my case study should be about him. I just kind of, he's one of those great clients that he moves around and calls me up and we build his teams. We've probably done it 5 or 6 times now.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
And this was really our first major endeavor in that. And it was so incredibly successful and just so much fun to do. And it was, I helped, he didn't have any team there, because it was a spinoff. So we helped him hire a head of HR, a head of finance and treasury, a head of legal. And we just kind of started building out. And then we did the director levels and the manager level. And then I started getting involved in sales and marketing. And the PE owners even took notice because we were bringing talent that was just top notch, frankly. And just actually in the past couple years, it's just so cool to see one of the managers I place is now the CFO. One of the first hires I place is now the CEO. And there's those moments that you look back and go, wow, this is awesome. Like, look at what has happened as a result of us, just assembling this amazing team that's done amazing things. And the business is now about $1 billion in revenue.
Wow.
It's changed hands multiple times. So this whole team has made tons of money. They've built a phenomenal company. They're having a blast. And when I saw the CFO get promoted, it just struck a real chord because I was just so proud of him. Like, we keep up. And when he got it, I was just like, this is amazing. So it's just, I think that's where when you're building teams, you become really part of the fabric of these companies and you get to know them so well. And it doesn't matter. A lot of times for me, it doesn't matter what hire they're trying to make, whether it be legal, sales, or my bread and butter, accounting and finance, you're looking for the right people. So if I get a certain number, hey, we're looking for these, I just have to go find that soft skills, that personality, that desire, that career drive, whatever it is that they're looking for that will help drive the company's growth and change and hopefully, last for a really long time. So that was a very fun one I'm still extremely proud of.
So that sounds like a blast. And I guess the question that makes me think is, what comes upstream of that in the sense of putting yourself in the position that you get to work on an opportunity like that?
Yeah. Again, I think a lot of this comes down to just building trust with every single person that you talk to, no matter what the conversation is about. I mean, that's to get the opportunity to do that was because of a great relationship I built. And when he became a CFO, I was one of his first calls. He just said, I want you to help me build this team. And it's, and then we've continued to do it over and over again. Just it's, and trust is really important, but execution is equally so. Not only do you get the opportunity, you got to hit it out of the park, right? Like, you got to get the job done and you got to get it done as quickly as possible. And that's where that underlying hustle comes in.
Right.
Like, you get a new search and I'm like, okay, we got to go. Let's do this. My team doesn't always like it because I can be very picky about who I'm going to submit. And I screen really, really carefully for a number of different things to make sure when we send somebody, they're at least close to the mark, right? But yeah, it's, I think that combination of trust and hustle, delivery and execution is just such an important piece to what we do on a daily basis.
Okay, that all makes sense. Catherine, what's your secret to building trust? Because I think anyone in business would say, you have to have trust to build relationships, etc. But how, you've obviously been very successful at it more than most. How do you build trust?
A variety of ways. I'm not in this job for the money at the end of the day. I mean, yes, I like to pay my bills and I want to live a nice life and have this, but I do this because I love what I do. And I do think that comes across when I'm talking to people. And when I'm talking to a prospective hiring manager or somebody who's looking for a new job, I talk to them the same way. It's about learning what they're looking for. How, what type of value can I provide? Being honest about where my limitations are. I absolutely love it when my favorite calls are when I talk to some top talent that's about to enter the market, right? That's like that MPC caliber talent, you know, any type of level. And I can get into really having a, what I call my strategy session with them, where it's not about me getting their job, getting them their next job. It's about identifying what they're looking for in their next opportunity and being part of that process. And I'm very honest by the fact that I am just a piece of the process, right? Most people get their jobs through their network. I mean, that's just an honest fact. So I'm just part of it, but I like to be involved in the process, give them some unbiased feedback or discussions or ideas. My belief is they don't need me to be marketing them or talking with people where they already have relationships or connections. I'm here to leave no stone unturned. And I think when you have those types of discussions and it's not about the money in the end. I tell them, I just want you to get your next opportunity. And then I want you to think of me when you're hiring for your next team, right? That's where it is. So it's not about that immediate payoff. And when you get rid of that, you know, only thinking about the transaction, people let their guard down and they just get to like you and then use your personality. And I think I'm fortunate to just break through with a lot of people just through my conversation style, or maybe it's my self-deprecating humor. I have no idea what it is, but, you know, usually once I have these discussions, you build a relationship that's strong and it turns into, and it pays dividends long-term, much more than that one placement would have paid.
Catherine, you've just given us our golden nugget for the episode. That was absolutely brilliant. And I hope people listening picked up on how brilliant what you just said is. So thank you so much for sharing, giving us an inside glimpse. And that's what I'm always striving for in these conversations, is to try and get underneath the surface and dig into, like, if I was sitting beside you, watching you and listening to how you do your job, what would I learn? What would I observe that I could apply to, you know, to be better at what I do? And so you've just given us a real glimpse of how you conduct. I liked even the fact you called it a strategy call rather than an interview, right? So it's a strategy call. I liked that positioning. I love the script, and you maybe didn't even realize it was a script. But anything you say more than once, folks, is a script. And it was along the lines of, look, I'm only a piece of this. You may well get your next job through your own network. I just want to help you to accomplish that. And I want you to think of me when you're looking to build your next team wherever you land. It was along those lines, right? And And you may not, maybe you don't say it quite that way, or maybe it's spread throughout the conversation, but those were the kind of the key points I picked up on, which are very disarming and very different to the way they may have been spoken to by the recruiters. And I can totally see now how you get them to let their guard down and, like, use you almost as like an advisor on their next career step. And then why you're the first recruiter they think of when they are looking to build their team. So now this is all coming together. So I can see why the CFO came to you and said, Catherine, we've just spun off this company. I want you to help me build this thing. So that's really cool.
It's fun. I mean, think about what we do for a living is such a blast, right? I mean, we get to be part of changing people's lives or accomplishing their goals. And I just love being a part of it. It's just, I consider myself like a fly on the wall, right? Like I'm just around, like hovering around, learning and listening and playing. And, it's just a blast. And when you see people like succeed and reach their goals, like this CFO that I mentioned, I mean, I take a little bit of pride in it. I mean, they're the one that did all the hard work, but I'm like, wow, he did it. And I've helped him hire. And we've just, you know, it's one of those things where that trust lasts for so long. And it makes me really proud of what I do for a living. I mean, recruiters sometimes get a bad rap out there, but the good ones are fantastic. And I want to set the bar very high for our business. I love what I do. I want more people to be drawn to it. And I want you know, people who, whether they work with me or not, to think highly of me, right? And how I hold myself from an ethical standard.
Love it. And by the way, the other thing I'm listening for, guys, when I'm talking to Catherine here is I'm trying to elicit her belief system. And so, Catherine, you shared some fantastic beliefs. So one is, I love what I do. And the other was, I'm proud of what I do. And that you set a high bar for yourself and for our industry. And you want to uphold the highest ethical standards. So some of the things that have come out as a course of this conversation, they give me a window into the way your mind works, Catherine. And I think these are really powerful belief systems. If you're going to perform at a high level, then you might well want to consider adopting some of the similar beliefs that Catherine has just shared. And you know, that's going to only boost the performance that you're able to get at yourself and the depth that you're able to connect with other people. Catherine, you mentioned MPC marketing a minute ago. Can you tell me?
I love it.
You love it. Okay, great. Let's talk about it then. Why do you love it?
It's a hunt, right? It's like I'm hunting out there. I'm trying to find things. And there's so many things that can come of it. I never know what's going to play out when I go out on an MPC. And I am consistently MPCing. I mean, most of the Atlanta market has heard from me multiple times on my MPCs. And I absolutely just get jazzed by the process. And it starts off with that strategy session that I mentioned. When I'm talking to a top talent, having that strategy session, defining what they're looking for, and then be able to go to market with this amazing talent that people should be lucky that I'm reaching out to them about. I have a little bit of that vibe to me. And it's just, you don't know if it'll, sometimes it uncovers a new client that maybe they're not looking to hire that person, but you build a rapport with that hiring manager so that they think about you for something else. Because it is a marketing aspect to my business, is I want to be seen as somebody who has access to the top talent in the market. I absolutely doing deep dives on industries that might be on the verge of kind of exploding. So for me, it might just be intellectual curiosity and pathways to kind of run down and learn about something and set the stage for future jobs that could come along the line. And I think it kind of gets back to just trying to find that where that person's next position is. So whether they're still employed or were affected in some sort of reorg, which happens obviously a lot, even at the higher levels for good people, I always say, hey, things happen for a reason. Let's go find your reason. Mm-hmm. Dream big. And I want to hear what their dreams are. And I want to go and find that. I want them to be excited. And I want them to be running towards their next opportunity, not running away from something. So that my job is to deliver as best as I can. And sometimes I can, and sometimes I can't. I can't place everybody, right? But it's so much fun to work with that person and try and figure it out, right? Like just identify the market, identify the companies, have conversations, get leads. Sometimes they go somewhere, sometimes they don't. Sometimes it happens quickly. Sometimes it takes 6 months to a year, depending on the level, right? But you just go through this process that is, it's a twist and turn, and you never know what's going to happen. So anything is possible when you start your MPCs. It could go anywhere. And I love to see where the process takes me.
I love it. That's a great summary. You just revealed another belief that I loved, which is people like these clients are lucky that I'm contacting them to, you know, give them the opportunity to, connect with this talent that you're representing. So, whereas I think a lot of salespeople, recruiters, business people feel when they're reaching out for new business, they feel like, oh, I don't want to, they feel like a pest, right? Like, oh, I'm sorry to bother you, or I won't take up much of your time. It's this kind of vibe. And yours is the exact opposite. It's like, you're thinking to yourself, they are really lucky that I'm calling them today, because this talent that could completely transform their business. That is a much more powerful mindset to adopt. What's your MPC process look like then?
It depends, honestly, on who I'm marketing and what market. Like in Atlanta may look different than if I'm going across the Southeast. But typically after that strategy session, I kind of go and do a deep dive of research on my own. Mm-hmm. So depending on who I'm thinking about marketing, is it a functional leader? Is it a industry specific leader? I'm going to go and do a lot of research and identify the companies that I need to be going after. And that could be an array of individuals. It could be, you know, the C-suite at companies. It could be private equity, like portfolio managers. It could be board members, right? Mm. Depending on the level. And I'll market to any of them. And I try to do it in a staggered process. You can't just reach out to everybody at one day, right? So I do a mixture of emails, obviously, where I build email campaigns. My email campaigns tend to be a little bit longer and meatier than they probably should be, but I've actually gotten more, I've gotten further with those because you can, they kind of take off and get forwarded around and you know, the tools that we use, you can kind of see when things spark an interest. So I may, I want as much content that's of value. You don't want it to be War and Peace, but you want it to be of value, right? To speak why this person, it makes a difference and is not your standard treasurer, your standard chief accounting officer, you know, general counsel, whatever it is, you need to be able to speak to what makes them different. Yeah. And so I'll do some sort of cadence with that, but then I'll also be following up with LinkedIn messages, with phone calls, with networking. Just, hey, do you know this person? Can you go and talk to them and put in a good word for me, right? Like doing that type of stuff. And then you can't rule out social media, right? I mean, LinkedIn is one of our strongest assets as recruiters. So while I'm doing that, I do try to post relevant content. And sometimes I've actually started to actually post about the people themselves if they give me permission to.
Oh, that's
and cool. It you just have to look at it as a multi-prong effort and really think of yourself as a marketing in person, not just a recruiter out there hammering away, just saying anything and everything to get somebody to answer. I try to do it in a way where, and eventually people start reaching out to me. Right? Like, hey, this is interesting. It takes a lot of effort, but it's a lot of fun too. So I maybe that's why I like it so much.
Okay. Fantastic. There's a lot of good stuff there. And something you said that I wanted to highlight is the length of the emails. And it's interesting because that's obviously working well for you. And it just shows that there's more than one way to do this. You know, the email platforms that we use generate data that shows that emails that are like 50 words or like 100 words max get a higher response rate. But obviously you've proven that sometimes a longer email gets a better response rate because it shows you've really put thought into, you know, what you want to present about this individual, right? So I love that you're just doing it your own way and it's working for you. Are there any other tips you can share as far as, because the people you're talking about, like board members, PE portfolio owners, CEOs, they're hard to reach, right? So like, yes. what's your secret for actually breaking through and getting, you know, the conversation with them?
A, it's the caliber of talent that's always going to get you the conversation.
Yeah.
So I really think talent is the what the most important pieces of any equation in what we do. If you're working with good talent, people are going to be interested. But you also have to be creative in how you get that information across.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be very genuine. I use my personality a lot, right? Whether it's a little bit of humor. Or just, you know, trying to sound eloquent on some level, right? Trying to just break through, be approachable, but not desperate, right? It's just like all of those, you kind of have to find your voice. And what works for me is not going to work for everybody, right? I mean, I have a very specific tone when people call me. Maybe we have a good laugh. Maybe, you know, I can kind of break the ice pretty quick with individuals, where some people have to lead with what they know and just be subject matter expert and a little more serious. So I think as long as you're being genuine and honest with who you are, when you get through to someone, whether it be through written communication, you know, LinkedIn, messages, or just voicemails, eventually you can kind of break through, but it's a volume game. A lot of people are never going to answer my phone and or answer my calls, and I don't take offense to it. Like, some people are just not going to like me, right? They're not going to want to work with me, and I'm okay with that. So, but I'm going to keep trying, and you never know. Maybe I'll break through some point.
Absolutely. You can't have, I've said this on a call recently, I don't think you were on that one. You can't have fans without also having haters, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not getting any pushback, it means you're not, you know, trying hard enough. You're not speaking to enough people. So fantastic. Thanks for sharing that, Catherine. Like, what you mentioned that you're able to break the ice quickly. How do you break the ice?
You know, that's a good question. Some of that I think is kind of something that I'm naturally do.
Yeah.
When I talk to people, I feel very lucky in that respect. I mean, historically, I don't take a lot of in-person meetings. Like, when everybody was like, I need to meet you in person, I need to do this, I build a lot on the phone. Mm. And I mean, I'm able to break through with individuals. And I love meeting people in person. But I'm also like, you have other things going on. Like, do you need me? And I also have always thought, I'm all about efficiency. I'm like, mm-hmm. I am a better service to you if I'm cranking away, not driving across town and missing out on a few hours, right? So I love just having honest, genuine discussions, the goods, the bads, the ugly of a search, of what's happened to them about a career, whatever it is. And I think maybe just my style of talking or communicating, I have no idea what it is. I'm hopefully able to instill some of that trust that's so important pretty quickly, where people start to connect with me. And I try to just not be assuming, but also always leave them with value, right? Like, I think about every time I pick up the phone and dial or have a call or Teams, whatever it is, I want somebody to leave that conversation with some nugget of information that's of value to them, whether it be market related or their job search or how they're building a team. So I think I give a lot more than I take. And I think that's probably an important piece to having these discussions overall. Sorry, didn't end that as well as I would have liked to, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's good. Giving more than you take, for sure. I am surprised, although I understand what you're saying about efficiency, but I'm surprised that you favor doing things over the phone or virtual meetings rather than in-person meetings. Because I've always found that meeting people in person is the best way to really break the ice and get to know people on a deeper level. And like in our case, for example, so we met in person twice before you became a client of ours. And I don't know if you maybe even would have become a client if we hadn't actually sat together over dinner, gotten to know each other on a more personal level. And, you know, that to me is an easier way to build trust than if it's a 30-minute Zoom call, right? So, but maybe you're just better on the phone than I am. I feel like I'm better in person.
No, I mean, I think it's a healthy mix, right? I think I've always led every discussion I have with the quality of my work, what I do, and how good I do it. And my goal is, you know, I want to be sharpshooter. I want to hit it on the first try, right? It doesn't always happen that way, but that my goal is, I set a very high bar for myself. And I don't, as much as I love meeting with people in person, I'm always happy to do it. I don't force it, because these individuals, they are busy and they have a lot going on. I can get a lot from, if somebody will give me 30 to minutes to an hour, or give me a couple of 30-minute discussions, you know, I can get a lot from that. I mean, I just helped a Fortune 1000 company here in town build out their entire accounting and finance function under the CFO, like everybody. Wow. Over the past 2 years, I have never been to their office. Like, we started working together in COVID, so never did, but we've all gotten to know each other so well. I can talk like I've been there and done it. Maybe it's just the questions, or
wow, that's interesting.
I just have kind of an innate sense to it.
But why wouldn't you, if you're both in Atlanta, why wouldn't you just, hey, why don't I pop around and we'll go and get lunch and...
It's bizarre. I used to drive past their office every day to go home. I mean, they are probably 15 minutes from my house.
Wow. And, okay.
And we talk about it all the time. And actually, we're going to do this fall. Like, I'm going to go there and see everybody, because it's a big team that I've helped them build. And we'd make, I mean, now we just kind of make jokes of it. Like, are you ever going to come and see us? Like, it'd be great to see you. But it's just, I don't know, maybe it's something I just have a natural take towards that I'm just very fortunate to have. But it hasn't ever been a necessary part of my process, although I do enjoy it when I do it. And I think that for some people, you have to do it. So you just have to kind of know yourself and figure out what works for you. And the lot of the clients I work with, they're okay with the fact that I don't go see them. They're like, awesome, just bring us good talent. And then when I deliver, they're like, done, we're good. So I don't know, it's a lucky trait, I guess.
Fair enough. So Catherine, I'm curious about your support team, because I know that you have, you said there's 3.5 of you, I think was the number. So what does that look like? And what's the structure of that? Because it's often, people always ask me, you know, if someone's a big biller, they're like, but like, who else is contributing to that outcome, right? It's very seldom that it's a one woman or one man show. There are a few people that we both know who bill a lot all by themselves, but it's extremely rare. In my experience, most people have some kind of a support system or a team behind that.
No, I mean, I couldn't do what I do without my team, honestly. And I've been working with a member of my team, Zena, she's my right hand. I mean, she makes me look so good at what I do. I mean, we just get each other, and she does a lot of research and recruiting. And, you know, we've worked together for, I think it's 11 years now, 12 years. And we can finish each other's sentences. I can be like, I need this. And she just knows at this point. She gets a little frustrated because I sometimes don't give her much more than that, but she runs with it. So yeah, she helps. And then we have a new hire, Megan, who just came on board, who's just getting up to speed, but I'm excited to get her on the business development train. And we have some support in Manila as well with Sarah, and then Ken as well.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so what parts of the process are your team members taking care of, and what part are you kind of driving?
I do most of the sales and client-facing work, mm-hmm. And that's something that this new hire, Megan's going to be doing more of as well. I want more than just me out in the market. Mm-hmm. So we're working on that. But historically, I have been the face of Resource Mosaic, where I'm the one who's building the relationships. I'm driving the process. No candidate gets submitted without talking to me first. But you know, Zena's doing a lot, and Megan are doing a lot of the candidate, you know, searching, finding, sourcing, screening, presenting to me, and then I take it from there.
Fantastic. That makes a lot of sense. So, by the way, I want to give a shout out to a regular listener of ours, Bill Bardani. And he recently, he enjoyed my podcast that he did with Jen Myers, who's a mutual acquaintance of ours.
Jen is so awesome.
She is, fantastic. And, that was a really popular episode. And he said, you know, really enjoyed the podcast with Jen. And, I would love to know, like, when I'm listening, and he said, often you ask, you know, these questions anyway, but I would always love to know things like, you know, is it contingent? Is it retained? Is it temp? Is it perm? Is it, what's the average, you know, fee value on all, like, almost do like a, for each interview that I do, kind of get the key facts so that he has a kind of frame of reference. And so I thought that was a cool idea. So do you mind if I ask you some quick fire questions to understand the, you know, the makeup of your operation?
Wouldn't be, no problem. Go for it. All right, I'll do my awesome. Best to answer them well.
All right. Fantastic. So you're doing primarily direct hire, permanent placements,
correct.
Right?
Correct. Only direct
all.
Hire.
Okay. No problem. And what is a typical placement fee for you?
Our standard is 25% for any contingent work that we do.
But what does that work out to in dollars normally?
Oh, standard fees, we're probably, oh gosh, maybe 50 to 60.
Okay. Cool. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And is it contingent? Is it retained, or is it a mixture?
It's definitely a mix. So I'm doing more and more contained and retained work these days. But, you know, I grew up in contingent. It's, mm-hmm. I think I've always described it as kind of like the bare knuckle recruiting side of things, you know, sharp elbows, all that kind of stuff. And I'll never shake that. I actually do love that world. And there's a place for it. And although most of my work is director level and above, I have to protect my director level above work by doing manager searches. And although I can get a container or retained on some manager searches, a lot of that's going to be contingent. And my team loves to work on that too. So I do bring in lower level searches to A, to help the team out work on things, but also to protect my client relationships. And I want to be the one person they call for any need that they have.
Love it. And then for the contingent ones, are you requiring them to work exclusively with Mosaic?
Absolutely. Yes. Doesn't always play out that way. Sometimes somebody else has already been engaged. But if there's more than two recruiters, including myself, on something, I'm not going to take it. Yeah. Unless I just have somebody in my back pocket I can fling at them. So 90% of the time, I'm going to be the only recruiter working on something.
Fantastic. So you do have the commitment, even though they may or may not be paying a deposit, right? I think that is the key. And the reason why we steer people towards engaged, contained, retained is getting that commitment from the client. Because one of the easiest ways to increase your billings is to fill a higher proportion of the searches that you're working, right? Catherine, this has been amazing. Before you go, I do want to ask about like challenge, because I know that you're a talented woman, but I don't want people to get the impression that, because you almost make it sound easy the way that you do what you do. What's been one of the biggest challenges or adverse situations that you've faced, either as a recruiter or a business owner?
I would say there's probably two things, right, that I would clump into my biggest challenges. And one is very, very clear. It was 2020.
Sure.
Like COVID just knocked us out, right? Like we started off 2020 thinking we were going to have the best year of our careers. We were like on fire. We were closing everything. And then March, it ended, right? Like it was just down. Like we were out. We were able to. I learned a lot in those down times where you just keep showing up, right? So I still worked every single day. Ken and I were in the office every single day. I would come in. I would, you know, maybe I wasn't working a full day, right? But I was there working at least 4 or 5 hours a day, talking to people, working with individuals that had maybe been laid off, right? Mm-hmm. Or were struggling, or, you know, we're going through things. I just kept talking to people and kept showing up. I kept marketing candidates. I just positioned myself and I was like, look, eventually we're going to come out of this. Like the world has to open up at some point, right? And when it did, I was fortunate to be primed and ready to go, to hit the ground running. And, you know, the next two, three years were time to rock and roll, right? So that was, you know, having the ability to continue to make those calls and show up, even though you're hearing no for 6, 7, 8 months, it was hard, right? But it also shows what you're made out of. And the people who got out of the business, well, their loss. I picked up all their work, right? Like it was just a really, really big struggle at that time. But, you know, we got through it and it worked out well. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about that because I know that because people reach out to me and share like what's happening in their world and we're connected to so many recruiters. There will be people listening right now who are going through their own struggle, or they're finding the market challenging or what have you. And so what did you do to stay motivated and to stay in the game and keep pushing and making the calls and doing the job, even though you were not getting the return that you would expect from that level of activity? How did you summon the motivation to keep pushing through?
It's simple. I just knew any day could be the day to make that break. Eventually, I knew the dam was going to break, right? I knew that people had hiring needs. I knew that people were looking for jobs or were not happy in their current roles. And I just knew that if I showed up every single day and did what I do, that at some point, it was going to pay off. So, and a little bit of it was taking it as a challenge. I'm like, this market's not going to break me. I'm not going to let this happen, right?
Yes, absolutely.
But I think what's most important is if you are committed to this business. You just have to keep showing up. It's like the people who join this business and it's really easy. And, you know, the past few years have been like that where, you know, you just had to sit by your phone and eventually it would ring, right? Like I didn't have to do a ton of marketing and, you know, 22 and 23 or 21 because of all of that. But I think it's one where the good recruiters are crafted in these challenging times. Mm. And I looked back to when the Great Recession happened and where a lot of people were leaving the business because they couldn't make a deal. I actually had some of my best years were those kind of 2 years where people were really struggling. And a lot of it was, you have to think creative. I got out of the Atlanta market. I was looking at small markets that still had hiring needs, but didn't have a lot of competition for recruiters. And you just have to think outside the box and just show up every day and commit yourself to our craft, right? Like, if you don't love this world, find something else to do because there's a lot of easier ways to make money out there, right? So,
well said.
So, I mean, I love what I do and I'm never going to give up on it. And I'm going to be here until I can't do it anymore, right? So, because it's what gets me up in the morning and what I get so excited to do. And even in the challenging times, I'm going to show up.
And on that note, that is a perfect way to finish the episode with those inspiring words from Catherine Wilcox. Catherine, that was so much fun. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been a blast. I've really, really enjoyed it.